The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. So, in thinking about what to talk about today, I thought it might be nice to give a kind of a summary of sorts of the day-long teaching we had here on Saturday. Some of you are here, I know. But I was here for the monk Tanisara Bhikkhu, who spoke last Monday here. He gave a day-long study class on the union, he called the union of mindfulness and concentration. And in particular, he focused a lot on what mindfulness means in the early Buddhist tradition and teachings of the Buddha. And the reason he felt, I think, moved to talk about his topic was to offer an alternative view to some of the more popular understandings of what mindfulness is that currently exist and are seen or around about. And one of the views that he's very keen on offering alternative to is the idea that mindfulness practice is only non-reactive acceptance of the present moment, non-reactive awareness of the present moment. As useful as that approach or that practice is, he wants to say that there's much more to what the Buddha meant when he practiced mindfulness. The other alternative he wants to offer is to the view that mindfulness practice is opposed to concentration practice. And there has been history in Buddhism of opposing the two. Some people will say, I do concentration practice. And other people say, I do mindfulness practice. I don't do concentration practice. And there's been a long history of struggle or strife between people who focus on mindfulness, people focus on concentration. It's rather silly, right? We have this great world religion that's whole purpose is to help free us from suffering. And then we use it in order to suffer more. Going to war with those people who have it right, those people have it right, and those people have it wrong. And so in many ways, like that class on Saturday has a lot to do with mindfulness. And he spoke in the beginning of the day about how the word mindfulness has become quite popular. In my own thinking about it, when I first got involved in Buddhism many, many years ago, decades ago, Zen was trendy. And there were a lot of books called Zen and the Art Of. A lot of books. I went to an academic talk by an American Zen scholar, and he spent about 5 minutes reading the list of all the books, you know, to make this impression on the audience at how many books there are. One of the more interesting books is the Zen and the Art of Diaper Changing. One of the most recent, it's not that recent anymore, maybe 10 years ago, but one of the more recent books that got the title Zen and the Art Of was a book written by a mindfulness student and teacher who's taught here, Rana Kabatsnik. It was using all that she learned about mindfulness practice to apply to eating, and her publisher called the book Zen and the Art of Eating. Even though she was a mindfulness teacher and she was teaching mindfulness in the book. Because that was still in that era where the word Zen got attention. Now, the pendulum has swung, and now mindfulness is the thing that's trendy. And now we have a lot of books about mindfulness this, mindfulness that. And now there's a whole little industry of books about mindful eating. So that's kind of what gets people's attention in mindfulness space, everything. Now it's not the mindfulness in the art of, that would be good. But mindfulness and the mindfulness based, this and that and this and that. To take the teachings of Tanisara Bhikkhu, the monk on Saturday, I suspect that if he was going to write a book with that kind of title, his title would be The Art of Mindfulness, or the, not the art, but the craft of mindfulness. Mindfulness and the craft of awakening, the craft of practice. Because he likes the word craft a lot. And partly because the Buddha himself, when he talked about the spiritual practice that he was teaching, when he made similes and metaphors for that, what that practice was about, tried to explain it to people, he very often used metaphors of the craft or the craft person. So someone who is shaping something out of clay, or someone who's turning wood on a lathe, making a wooden bowl, someone who's shaping an arrow shaft, someone who's training a horse or training an elephant, kind of very ordinary, so in ancient India, crafts or skills that people were used to, that people did. And in using those analogies or those metaphors for meditation, he was likening then meditation to, that saying that meditation has a similar aspect to it as any craft that you would develop. And one of the key aspects of a craft is that it takes practice. And you don't sit down, or some people do, one of my sons does this, sits down to learn something, and if he's not proficient immediately, then he's a failure. And I have told them so many times about practice. You have to keep doing it for a while, but that seems to fall often on deaf ears. But the idea that you would practice something, and there is in meditation circles sometimes people who expect instant results, or they want a teaching that kind of points to some kind of instant awakening or something. And that's fine, it can be quite profound, but the way the Buddha presented the practice was, we're kind of doing something to develop the mind, to cultivate the mind, to train the mind. And so I have these quotes from the Dhammapada that I'll read. The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control, the sage makes straight as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. So the fletcher is the person who makes arrows. So it's a craft. So it's comparing again, making the mind straight, like a fletcher would an arrow. Or this one here, similar. Irrigators guide water. Fletchers shape arrows. Carpenters fashion wood. Sages tame themselves. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. So what does it take to become happy? What does it take to become peaceful or free? And for the Buddha, part of it is to discipline the mind, and part of it is to watch the mind, to train the mind, to shape the mind. And the reason the Buddha can say this is that the mind is not a thing in Buddhism, but the mind is a process or a series of processes. It's an activity or a series of activities. And activities, because it's an activity or process, doesn't have to be stuck in a particular way. It can be shaped, it can be transformed, it can be changed, the activities can become something else. And so we don't have to stay stuck with the mental activities that are currently going on if they're not useful for you. But you can take responsibility, and with patience and training, practice, you can begin shifting the activity of the mind. So the activity, the process of the mind are more beneficial for you, more helpful. And that process of doing that is part of the process of Buddhist training. And in doing that, I think we have to appreciate that the human mind, if you prefer the word heart, you're welcome to do that because the word in Buddhism is synonymous. Some people prefer the heart because it feels much more closer to their heart to their kind of emotional being. Mind can seem kind of intellectual. But we appreciate that this inner life is a vast ecology. It's a vast ecosystem that has many aspects to it. Actually, many activities involved. And so part of the practice is to appreciate that at different times, in different situations, with different inner states of mind, that we address our mind in different ways. We focus on different activities as being useful to work with. So to say this in a little different way, there are three large classes or categories of mental activities, mental faculties, that are activated or utilized when people do Buddhist practice, like meditation practice. Each of these categories has all these different aspects within them. So the first category is category of mental faculties having to do with observation, watching what's going on. The second is that of making effort. And the third is the faculties, the categories of activity that has to do with relaxing. So under observing, there are such things as mindfulness, contemplation, reflection, observation, wisdom, discernment, and the Buddha would wisdom. And for the language of this monk on Saturday, Tanisara Bhikkhu, also involves judgment, which raised a lot of excitement in the group. He gave a whole talk yesterday morning about judgment and wanted to redeem or redefine the value of judgment for us all. So all those things kind of fit under the category of watching. And then the category of activity has to do with effort. Certainly is energy, is persistence, making effort, engagement, involvement, interest. Interestingly enough, issues like joy and happiness come together around this category called effort. And then the third category, you know, this thing of relaxation, has to do with concentration, tranquility, serenity, contentment, acceptance, peace, things like that. So you get a sense there's actually many, many kind of qualities of the mind that are being pointed to, and depending on what's going on, we would utilize them in different ways. Or we would develop these qualities. So for example, a person who's really hyped up, really super anxious and involved, and your mind is in overdrive, and maybe there's a fair amount of anxiety, you might not want to teach them to pay attention too much, to do a lot of observation, because they might look carefully and get much more anxious about what they see. And it might spin out even further. Maybe what's best to teach them is to relax and to focus on maybe a concentration practice, a relaxation practice, something that just helps them to settle down. For someone who is really lazy and just kind of really complacent about things, perhaps what's needed first is to strengthen their effort, their energy factor, to make more effort. There's a book came out called The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment. And that sounds good. But, and then for someone who maybe is completely out of touch with themselves, but perhaps, you know, at a time when they're kind of pretty relaxed about things, for them, maybe the thing to be emphasized is observation, is to look more carefully at what's going on. Mindfulness, or this capacity to observe, sits at the center of all this, because there has to be some monitoring of ourselves in order to know what's needed at any given time. So if you're hyped up, you have to hopefully recognize that's what's going on. It's, I'm so anxious right now, or so energized, I think what I need to do is relax. Or I'm really sleepy right now, or kind of dull. What's needed is I need to arouse more energy. One of the things that fits under the category of effort, I didn't mention, is desire. And the Tanissarabhuku made a big point that desire has a very important role in the teachings of the Buddha. There's a strong kind of modern tendency to think that all desire is unacceptable for Buddhists. Buddhism is to free you from desire. But he wants to say, no, desire is a very important quality. You just have to have the right kind of desire. So desire fits into this, is what supports effort. So these are all these qualities that come into play, and it's our job to understand what's needed at any given time. And that mindfulness or the observing qualities is that which has to be enough monitoring to see what it is. And then when we see what's there, see what's needed, then with that then can come a choice, a decision, to begin training, to cultivate and develop certain faculties and skills that we have. Some people would like their spiritual life to mostly be involved with understanding, with knowledge. And you see it particularly with people who are nightstand Buddhists. Where it can be very, very inspiring to read a book about wisdom and get all this wisdom and, oh, I knew that, that's right. Or hear a Dharma talk like this one, perhaps, and think, oh, now I understand. And get kind of a contact high, you know. Or feel like there's something, you know, really special, but now you know. Now, it feels wise, you feel like you got it. But it doesn't go that far. It doesn't, it doesn't reach out of bed in the morning. There's a great prayer. This person says, thank you, God, for this day. I have lived wisely and haven't harmed anyone or myself yet. But now I really need your help, because now I'm about to get out of bed. So as useful as knowledge is, knowledge doesn't go that far. And it doesn't really help us get out of trouble or really develop our lives. It's like going to the reading books on weightlifting. I suppose if the book is heavy, that would help. But and the reason I chose the example of weightlifting or bodybuilding is that what's interesting about one of the things that's interesting about bodybuilding here is that it also involves developing a craft. It's kind of your body is the object of the craft, and there's all the skill that goes into kind of shaping that particular thing that you're shaping. It's a craft. And what's interesting about weightlifting, I think, if I understand right, is that the very thing that you use is what's being crafted, right? So if you're learning a musical instrument, it's the musical sound that's coming out that you're crafting. And you learn all these skills to do it, but the product is something different from the activity that creates the product. With bodybuilding, I think, it's kind of like the thing you use is also the product. So the same thing with mindfulness, with meditation practice. The very thing that you're using is that thing which is being developed. And so we're beginning to utilize these qualities and as we use them, they become stronger and stronger. So it requires us recognizing what these qualities are. So in the teaching of the Buddha, mindfulness is one of the qualities of observation, this observing quality of the mind, aspect of the mind. And mindfulness is both a faculty, a particular function of the mind, and also a collection of practices that function together with that faculty of mindfulness. Do you understand that? So I'll try to say it again. And this is important because it can be people are often confused because they're kind of vague, ambiguous about what they're talking about in their language. So mindfulness is both a particular activity, a particular faculty, and it's also the faculty used together with other things. So the example is, running is a faculty you have. You could run. And if I tell all of you, today I ran. That's one thing. Maybe I was running after the bus. Maybe the police was running after me. Maybe I was running for exercise. Maybe I was, you know, late for something and running, you know, or maybe I just had, I sat down in the wrong place and I had ants in my pants. You know, just I say I ran doesn't say much. But if I say, today I was involved in training to run. I have a training practice of running. Then you know that I run, but you know there's a lot of other things that go together with that. One is if you're training to be a runner, there's regularity of practice that's important. There's a certain kind of monitoring that goes on, a certain kind of activities that go together with that training exercise, training activity of running. So in the same way with mindfulness, there's just being mindful, and then there's a training in mindfulness. And the training in mindfulness is much more than just being mindful. It involves doing a lot of other things as well. So it involves, for example, if you want to train in mindfulness, develop that capacity to be mindful, you need to do it regularly. There has to be a regular practice. It helps if you do it every day on a regular basis. If you just think it's a good idea to be mindful and once in a while you get around to it, you know, that's good. Every moment of mindfulness is helpful. But if what you want to do is to shape the mind, to craft the mind, develop a skill of the mind, you're not going to develop it unless you practice it and do it. And so what is mindfulness then? What is this? So it's much more than just acceptance of the present moment, non-reactive awareness of what's here. For the Buddha, mindfulness and mindfulness practice involves a number of things. In being a faculty, a single faculty of the mind itself, mindfulness means holding something in the mind. And so if you want to go shopping, and say you have make a mental shopping list, to remember that shopping list means that you held that shopping list of things in your mind. You're mindful of that list. You have to hold it there. And mindfulness is very closely connected in Buddhism to the faculty of to remember. So we remember to be present in the present moment. We remember to be with our breathing. If we're being mindful of the breath, we're remembering to stay there with our breath. And we're cultivating strength in our capacity to remember, or strength and capacity to hold the attention in some place that we choose to hold the attention. So it could be the breath, it could be any activity at all, we choose to keep our attention there. Sometimes people do mindfulness practice, the choice is to pay, what they choose to pay attention to is the present moment, what's going on in the present. And however, the present moment is such a big, complicated event. There is a lot going on in the present moment. Some people will practice just mindfulness of whatever is most compelling in the present moment, whatever is most loudest, whatever is going to get their attention. That's okay. And sometimes it's a very wise approach to practice. It's called choiceless awareness. But for the Buddha, he emphasized actually choosing what you pay attention to, not leaving it to chance. But actually, some things are more useful to pay attention to other things. So in other words, you would hold certain things in awareness in the present moment and, or choose some things over other things. For example, it's not particularly useful to spend a lot of time focusing on your little toe. You could. I mean, your little toe is in the present moment. Your little toe had, you know, there's sensations, there, experience there. But there's no, as far as I know, I've never really heard any spiritual instruction that it's particularly useful to pay attention to your little toe. But they do say, pay attention to your breathing. And that's a very common instruction. There's something very, very hugely different between the benefits you get from focusing in the present moment on your breath versus focusing on your little toe. For one thing, the breathing is a wonderful feedback loop that helps us to relax. We focus on the breathing. Most people find that the focus and staying with the breath concentrates people, relaxes people. There's a wonderful feedback loop between our emotional life or even our unconscious life and our breathing. And as we begin breathing in a more mindful way, the ways in which we hold our breath, contract our breath, restrict our breath, begins to release. And as the breath gets softer, more relaxed, it then has it feeds back and changes our inner life. It tends to relax and settle things as well. So it's more useful to pay attention to that. Paying attention to, I could pay attention all day to the sounds of the birds in my garden. Now, it's possible to get concentrated. It might be nice. The Buddha said it's actually useful to have a broad awareness of your body, of what goes on in your body. And because the body provides a lot of information about what goes on with you. In fact, in my years of practice, what I've learned is the information that I acquire, I get from my body by paying very, very careful attention to it, provides me with much more accurate and deeper insight into what goes on in my mind than if I paid attention only to my mind. It's kind of like I think of the body as the royal road to the unconscious. So it's useful to learn to cultivate a strong presence of awareness in the body, in our posture, in the contractions and the releases of our body and what goes on there. It's useful to do that. So the Buddha went through and said there's a number of things that's useful to hold in your mind, to pay attention to. And so he said the body, the breathing. It's useful to pay attention to what's called the feeling tone of experience. It's useful to pay attention to your mental states. And it's useful to pay attention to some of the core processes of the mind that are operating that either move us towards greater bondage, greater suffering, or moves the mind to those processes that move the mind towards greater freedom and release. To start becoming sensitive to what goes on in the mind, so that we can monitor what's there. And then, and this is one of the key parts of mindfulness practice, as talked by the Buddha and also by this monk on Saturday, is that mindfulness is not only just observing what's there and holding in mind the present moment, but it's also making choices. So first of all, there's choice like, oh, it's more useful to pay attention to my breathing than to pay attention to the sound of the birds in my garden. So I think what I'll do here is I'll stay with my breath. Or maybe because of how state of my life, my mind, maybe at this particular time, it's most useful to do choiceless awareness, where I choose not to choose anything. It's still a choice. So we monitor ourselves to see what's useful, and then there's a choice about what to pay attention to. If you don't know how to choose, or tying yourself in knots by being too choiceful, their suggestion is that in meditation, just focus on your breath. Make it easy for you. But as you start becoming aware of these things, there's choices that can be made. So when you start becoming aware of what goes on in the mind, then we start making choices about what mental activities to pursue and which not to pursue, which to be involved in and which not to be involved in. And one of the key ones is thinking itself. And there's a world of difference between being involved with thinking, lost in the conversation, versus stepping back and watching, observing, oh, here's a mind that's thinking. To watch it, oh, thinking is happening. And I hope that all of you learn to see the difference between being lost in thought, absorbed in thought, where you're engaged in thinking and feeding the thinking, where you're living in your thinking, versus stepping back and seeing, watching, oh, here's thinking going on. The difference would be kind of like if you're at a wonderful gathering of many animated people, like at a party, and they're talking maybe animated discussion, argument about politics, say. And everybody, you're in the fray, and everybody's yelling, it's not pretty, and casualties are happening left and right. And people are talking on top of each other and interrupting each other, and it's all very exciting and so important, and your opinions are so important, and you're just in there getting your opinions across, and everybody kind of forgets themselves. But then something happens, and for some reason or other, you step out of the fray. Maybe you have to go to the bathroom, or your cell phone rings, and you go out, and then you come back, and everybody's still involved in the fray of the arguments. But you stand at the edges of it, and you watch. And you say, wait a minute, I was in there a few minutes ago. hardly even aware of myself. And now I'm stepping outside and I can see what all these people are doing, all the arguments and all the gestures and movement and how everybody's lost. And some of them even have kind of seem like they're almost, look at their eyes, and it seems like they're addicts. Opinion addicts. And isn't this amazing? I was one of those people just a few minutes ago. So I don't know if that's a good example or analogy, but to step out of the fray of your own mind, all the arguments and discussion and memories and plannings and everything, not so much because you have to stop doing it or say it's bad to do it, but to step back far enough so you can observe this phenomenon going on. And there's a huge difference between observing and being in the world of thinking. Now, once you observe the phenomena of thinking, it does begin giving you give you some choice of what to do about that. One choice is to stay there, to keep coming back to observing as opposed to being in it. Another is to evaluate what you're thinking about. Is this useful to think this? And if it's not useful, perhaps you can change what you're thinking about. So you notice, for example, you're thinking a lot of nasty thoughts about someone. Do you really want to spend so much time of your life thinking nasty thoughts? Is that really a useful use of your precious moments of being alive? No, maybe there's other things to do. Perhaps it would be more useful to reflect and think about what are that person's good qualities. And so you can sometimes you can change what you're thinking about. Or you can choose to let go of that thinking, to not think that at all. And one of the ways to cultivate and strengthen the capacity to observe, to be mindful, is to let go of whatever we're thinking about. Or that to let go with the addiction to think, the preoccupation to think. And that's one of the great skills to learn. And again, it's a skill, it's a craft. We're shaping the mind. We're shaping the mind, but we're slowly, over time, helping the mind become soft enough, relaxed enough, so it's easy to let go. A mind that is really hard and tight, contracted, it's very hard to let go, to soften. It's like the analogy that I like to use is like if one analogy would be, ice, if you have, is really hard. And if you want a little drop of water from the ice, it takes some, to maybe chip away at it or something. But if you want a drop of water from a glass of water, it's really easy to separate it out. So when your mind gets very soft, it's like water. And it flows and moves and can be shaped in all kinds of ways. It's very clear, like water, clear water. Ice is not that clear. So if the mind is preoccupied with anxiety, with fear, with hate, with greed, with lust, many, many things it can be caught up in, It can be so caught up, the mind gets actually tighter and tighter, more and more constricted, harder in a sense. And then it's hard to do anything with the mind. So as we begin meditating and relaxing, making effort, being regular with practice, being mindful of what's there, we slowly, and by exercising the choice, the simple choice of stepping back, slowly the mind begins to relax. Slowly the heart begins to soften. And the more it softens, the more choice we have. And the more choice we have, the more we can then choose to let the mind's activities be healthy activities. And so for the Buddha, one of the very important parts of spiritual practice is to be able to differentiate between those mental activities which are unhealthy to pursue, to be involved in, and those which are healthy to pursue in. And I just read somewhere, I think yesterday, I think, that one of the serious issues that probably many of you have to face is a particular kind of addiction to technology, to computers and cell phones and to texting. And there are plenty of people, apparently, who the first thing they do in the morning is to check email or check, see what's going on online. And then people get pulled into that world. And sometimes it's very hard to pull away. Someone, a wife, told me on Saturday, she pulled out her iPhone And she said, you know, I'm kind of addicted to this iPhone of mine. And it's actually a marriage ruiner because of, you know, separation, kind of lost in that world. So to recognize, oh, this is not healthy, this is not useful, and then have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to follow that addiction, that involvement. To see that it's not useful to be, that particular trains of thoughts are not healthy for you, and then be able to let go of them and choose ones that are healthy. So for the Buddha, that ability was considered a very, very important part of spiritual life. We don't just sit there to accept how things are, but part of the function of mindfulness is that mindfulness helps us to see wisely what should we allow to happen and what not to happen. So the analogy from the Buddha that was given on Saturday was that of a gatekeeper in an ancient citadel, an ancient city where they had, you know, a wall around the city. And there was a gate, and the gatekeeper was a person who stood at the gate and decided who could come into the city and who could not, who can come through the gate. And that part of the function of mindfulness is to be the gatekeeper. So something arises in the mind in the present moment, and you don't have to feel ashamed or guilty or bad about what arises in your mind. But when it arises in the mind, the function of the mindfulness practice is to say, oh, that particular hate, that particular fear, that particular self-criticism, that particular lust, that way of thinking, I don't need to go there. Let's not go there. Let's not let that in. Let's not get involved. And one of the strongest ways of doing this, because it's hard to let go sometimes, is to come back to a very clear mindfulness of the thinking itself. The clearer, more precise the mindfulness is, the less we're involved or entangled or lost in it. And so again, if I could use another analogy that I like, is that of you've gone for a nice walk, on a beautiful spring day, you sit down at the edge of a riverbank, and you back against the oak tree in the shade, and you have a wonderful lunch. You take a nice nap. It's wonderful. Wake up from the nap, you feel so refreshed. Everything's perfect and wonderful in life. You look around, and you say, wow, look at this beautiful scenario, the beautiful river. It's so pastoral and so nice. Just being present, just being alive is enough. Nothing's needed. But then, floating down the river is a showboat. Big flashing lights, casino, discotheque, the whole works. And before you know it, you've been on the showboat for a week. How did that happen? So finally, after a week, you wake up. Maybe you could use all your money up or something. And so you make it back, you make your way back on shore, and you've make your way all the way back up to that oak tree. You sit down and rest there, and everything's fine for a few moments. And then a war boat comes down the river. And the next thing you know, you're on this war boat fighting a war. It takes you a while to realize that where you are, and finally you wake up, and so you make it back to the dry shore, the safe shore, and go back up under your oak tree again, minding your own business, just being there. Committed, okay, I'm not going to give in. Whatever beautiful showboats come in, I'm not going to get on, I'm just going to stay here. Everything's fine here, peaceful, nice. The war boats come, I'm not going to get on those wars. And have, you know. So you're pretty good until this decrepit, barely floating, poor little raft comes floating down. You know, you feel so sorry for the poor raft. It's so dangerous. And before you know it, you're on the raft. Feeling sorry for yourself. Oh, it's so hard. It's about to sink. And you're on that raft. It takes a few years to get off that one. So the idea in mindfulness is that you're safer on shore. And watching the stream go by, watching the boats go by, so watching the thoughts go by, you don't have to pick them up, you don't have to get involved. And so one of the ways to exercise this choice, this mastery that happens in meditation, is to choose to stay with the mindfulness, to stay being mindful of what's happening without getting involved, And it's very simple things to recognize, oh, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. To choose that over choosing getting involved. Or to choose that this is not useful to do, but this is. So as we do this, as the mindfulness gets stronger, as the capacity to observe gets stronger, as the ability to stay present for the body, be mindful of the body, mindful of the breath, feelings, mental states, as this gets stronger, then with that comes a stronger concentration. And concentration has a function of helping us to see with greater intensity, with greater unity, with greater settledness and composure, what's happening here in the present moment. Concentration has the function of beginning to relax deeply, create a kind of serene ease in our body that comes when the mindfulness gets strong, and create a subjective experience that's very, very pleasant. And one of the things that's what really helps the process of mind shaping, like bodybuilding, mind building, is that that we're beginning to shape a subjective experience that's very pleasant, that's very enjoyable. And it's one of the, I don't know if it's a paradox, but one of the aspects of meditation practice can seem very odd at first, is that the mind thinks that enjoyment is found in the external world of things. That our safety is found in the external world of things. But there's a kind of deep, deep, satisfying enjoyment and sense of safety that comes from a subjective sense of being mindful, observant, present, and then settled and unified around that experience, concentrated here. And so with that, then, so as the mind becomes more and more mindful, more and more clear and crisp, more pristine in its clarity, there's a subjective feeling of ease and safety that arises as well. And that makes it easier for the mind to let go further and further and further. In fact, the more the mind lets go, the more satisfying it is. And rather than letting go being something which is frightening or undesirable, it's really clear that the very desirable thing that enhances us, it doesn't diminish us, it enhances us, is to let go of all the places of clinging, of holding, of resistance, of tightness, all the ways in which the mind, the heart, is kept limited or bound or caught up until the mind lets go of itself in a very deep way. So mindfulness is part of a larger project in Buddhism that involves a sense of autonomy, to use language I heard recently. Autonomy, because only you can develop this capacity to take responsibility for your mind and develop the capacity to see. It develops our sense of mastery, because we do become master or become skilled at working with our mind. The mind is not a foreign place, but it's something we slowly, very slowly over time, get a handle on and become kind of get skilled with how to use it. And then it's connected to a sense of purpose. Mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition is connected to the purpose of creating mental health, but more than mental health, of bringing the mind to spiritual liberation and freedom. And that sense of purpose is what guides the choices that mindfulness helps us make as we're mindful. Mindfulness is connected to a desire. Mindfulness is connected to a sense of purpose that informs how we're mindful and what we're mindful of. So, concluding words, the human mind is kind of like an ecosystem. It has many species live in this ecosystem. And at different times in Buddhist practice, we focus on different aspects of that ecosystem. It's meant to be an enjoyable process. It's meant to be a simple process. It doesn't have to be so complicated. But we pick up different aspects. Sometimes we focus on relaxing. Sometimes we focus on seeing clearly what's there. Sometimes we focus on applying more effort. These three qualities, these three aspects, are mutually supportive of each other. And they circle around each other and benefit each other. And when a person has become well-skilled, well-developed in Buddhist practice, those three qualities are like the three tripods that are strong, well-developed, that support the further growth of the practice. So, for those of you who are here Saturday for the class, I hope I did justice to the class, to what Thanissara Bhikkhu said. And if it all seems too complicated, all this stuff, then just follow your breath. Thank you.